Hello, Jesse.
On my pop shield.
What happened to your pop shield? Oh, God. Something got in my eye.
As I was counting the clap, I was just staring at my pop shield because there was a fuzzy right in the middle of it.
And I think, and I, like, I think I clapped a fuzzy in my eye.
We are fine. We are so fine. We are doing great.
Oh, my God.
My God. This is our hell week.
Seriously.
This was our Frank chair collapsing.
I need to take a Claritin, apparently.
Okay. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure? Wipe the tears away.
Ready graphics? Ready theme?
Hi, I'm Jesse Mullins.
And I'm Lauren Milberger.
And this is FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast.
Jim Dial, everybody.
Men with less hair and the women who love them.
Pure moods adjacent.
Like a laughing Frankenstein.
Oh, I'm obsessed with this blue outfit.
Because that's how great Jim is.
And on today's episode,
we'll be talking about Season 3, Episode 7, The Last Laugh.
Well, hello, everyone.
Hello, Jesse. Hello, audience.
Hello, audience. You may hear a special glint in my voice today because we are doing an episode. In the way that everyone was waiting for us to do Gold Rush for Lauren, I think everyone knew we were waiting to do this episode for me.
Yes, it is a cornucopia of Jim moments.
Oh, what a gift. Let me tell you, for Jim fans, obviously, I don't think there's anyone here who's an anti-Jim fan,
yeah, no.
But for those of us who are dedicated to our good old man, Jim, this handsome bastion of professionalism and just overall goodness, this episode is such a treat. It's such a payoff for all of us who have loved him from Go. Not only do we get just a bunch of really funny, standard, like good Jim content and Doris, but we also get to see the other side of Charlie Kimbrough's excellence as a performer,
yes,
which is this grounded vulnerability and sincerity. It's, man, this packs a couple punches, like more than one punch.
Yeah, and it brings up something that we've talked about in the past, particularly about Jim, but about comedy in general, is that, you know, the laugh comes from not just the unexpected, but from the contrast. Mm-hmm. So the best thing to do is to take a character who is very, you know, stoic and professional and put him in a situation where he becomes the exact opposite of what he is. Although I feel like he thinks he's being unprofessional. I don't know if I would say he's unprofessional. I would say he's a human. But like it's, it's putting him in a very big conflict and then getting to see him react.
And I also think there's also a conventionally unprofessional, like the convention of professionalism, especially for his generation.
Oh,
in
yes,
the role that he is.
Absolutely.
That's where that perception comes from. So I can see there was probably a group of people when this happened to him that thought it was very unprofessional.
Oh, totally.
We don't, because we love our Jim and we love seeing people break because it's fun. We love seeing the humans. But I think it's similarly, and this is something we talk about constantly, is the reason Jim works is also the contrast of casting someone like Charlie in that role, which we've talked about this before, is so funny to us now to perceive that as such a contrast when that is what Charles Kimbrough was booking a lot, to his chagrin. He was often booking that type of character. So casting him probably actually wasn't as against type as we know now, because we've had this time to understand that what makes Jim so great is the fact that Charlie Kimbrough is not a Jim, but type-wise in the casting world he was seen as a Jim, so it made sense. But the truth of the brilliance of casting him is that he is not that man, but he understands it very well to play it to his comedy gold.
Yeah, you got to be smart to play dumb. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this episode was written by Tom Palmer, who we mentioned in the first episode, is new to the Murphy Brown writing staff. It is directed by Barnett Kelman, and it aired November 12, 1990.
So welcome, Tom, to the writer's room and our hearts.
we reached out to Tom. This is the first time that we've had a writer that is not in the Murphy Brown book. So since we have self-written bios from the Murphy Brown book for all of our other writers, we thought as an introduction to Tom, we reached out to him and he sent us a little biography to read. Okay, so here we go. Tom Palmer became a television writer upon the realization that his first love and true talent, writing filthy limericks, would never bring him the acclaim, big money, and multiple wives he had always dreamed of. His come-to-Jesus moment was a fortuitous chance meeting with Diane English in a seedy, dimly lit urban parking lot late one night. She had a dead battery. He had jumper cables. It was dark and strange men were gathering. While Diane nervously waited for her battery to recharge, Tom took the opportunity to recite 47 of his best limericks. Sensing he needed a big finish to impress, he launched into what he considered to be his magnum opus. There once was a fellow named Spiegel who had an affair with a seagull. When Diane abruptly screamed and blurted out she would hire him as a staff writer on My Sister Sam if he would please just shut up. Adding that the traditional sitcom form was more than just five moronic lines and none of it rhymes, especially with the word pedendum. The next day, Diane bought a very expensive white Porsche with an exceptionally powerful battery, so something like this could never happen again. Following My Sister Sam, Tom went on to work with Diane on seasons 3, 4, and 5 of Murphy Brown, created and executive produced Living in Captivity for Fox and Diane C. Productions, and also took up office space for the 2018 Murphy reboot. A few of Tom's other credits include Coach, The Naked Truth, and Mad Men, which had absolutely no problem with the word pedendum.
They didn't.
No, they did not. So that's Tom.
So welcome, Tom. We're so happy you're here. I am particularly glad you're here because you have brought me one of my favorite episodes.
Now we have the TV Guide synopsis for these. We have Murphy's antics have Jim in stitches on the air, but it's no laughing matter when he's so broken up over breaking up that he decides not to return.
And then there's a description when it was rerun that refers to it as an infectiously funny repeat that spotlights Charles Kimbrough.
Which we all agree.
The episode, we're back to a montage with a song.
We are.
We haven't had one of these in a while. So before we get into what the song was, it is a montage of serious, iconic anchormen ending with the one, the only, Jim Dial. Now, Lauren, do you have the list of who is on there?
I have a question for you. Okay, so it's we have Murrow, Cronkite, mm-hmm. and then someone I can't place. His outfit looks it's from the 70s. I Googled a bunch of people who I thought it could mm-hmm. be, as well as 1970s anchors. And I'm sorry, people who are probably yelling at us, who are older than us, I couldn't figure out who it was. But then we have Brokaw and Mike Wallace and then Dan Rather.
Mm-hmm. I will be honest. I wrote down those ones and then I just kept watching because I was like, the one I don't pick out, Lauren will know.
And I don't. I'm sorry, everyone.
So, y'all, we finally did it. We finally dropped the ball on one of these. So please tell us. What matters is it is great, iconic anchormen through time, all noted for being voices at very important moments in mm-hmm. current events of the time, voices of reason, voices of stalwart professionalism. And the last one we see is, of course, the most current, Jim Dial.
Yes.
But what is the song that's playing?
Yeah, so it's Something About You, sung by the Four Tops. Now, we've had songs from the Four Tops in episodes, but they haven't been mm-hmm. in the opening. So I thought this would be a great time to talk about the Four Tops since we haven't really gone into their history. Just to remind people, the songs that we had originally were Reach Out, I'll Be There, which is in Soul Man, and then Baby, I Need Your Loving, which of course is Jake and Murphy's song. Now, quickly, Something About You was released in 1965 as a single off their album titled Four Tops' second album, which makes me laugh. The song reached number 19 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 9 on the Billboard R&B chart. It was written by Jesse
Holland, Dozier Holland.
Something About You is very distinctive in the Motown sound of tight harmonies and a driving rhythm section, but it is mm-hmm. also apparently known for its guitar riff, which is not usual for Motown. But as we talked about in My Girl, is something part of that song that is quite famous. The same man did both guitar riffs on both songs, Robert Wife of the Funk Brothers. We have talked about the Funk Brothers before.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Right? Yeah. The song is considered a staple of the Four Tops, as well as one of the best songs of all time on many lists. And for Jesse,
Holland Dozier Holland,
they were sort of their muse. This was sort of the known male group that the songwriters Holland Dozier Holland wrote for. Mm-hmm. Other popular songs include I Can't Help Myself, Sugar Pie Honey Bun in 65. Oh. As we mentioned, Reach Out, I'll Be There in 66. It's the same old song, which I will not go into because we will be going into the history of that song later on in the season.
Yes, we will.
The Four Tops are considered part of the pantheon of groups that are considered the pioneers of the Motown sound. That would also include the Temptations, the Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas, and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. Interesting enough, the Four Tops started as the Four Ames, and like many Motown groups, began singing in high school in Detroit. The members included Levi Stubbs, Abdul Duke Fakir, Ronaldo Obi Benson, and Lawrence Payton. They performed together with no replacements from 1953 until 1997.
Jeez.
Now, what's also interesting is that they were notable because Stubbs was a baritone, whereas most lead singers in vocal groups like this were tenors.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when they signed with Motown originally, they were not an instant commercial success until they paired with Jesse,
Holland Dozier Holland,
and the group started to produce hits together. In 1967, we have mentioned that
Holland Dozier Holland
left Motown, and then in 72, the Four Tops also left. They signed with ABC, hoping to have more control over their music, but they never really reached the same success or sheer dominance that they achieved at Motown. The Four Tops were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990, into the Vocal Group Hall of Fame in 1992, and Rolling Stone ranked them as 79 on their list of 100 greatest artists of all time.
I don't disagree with that.
Right?
So we make our way into the wrap of what was the week's FYI production. And Corky is signing off. She says, and so ends a day in the life of the women at the Lexington Federal Penitentiary. Jim? Jim looks at her, thanks her, says it's interesting, the correlation, the remarkably high number of women on death row who never joined a sorority. And Corky just looks so proud of this, like, journalistic deep dive that she did. This correlation she found. It was like, look at how few of them were in sororities.
What I love about this is that this is a very important issue, right? Corky still isn't quite there of understanding the seriousness of it.
I actually disagree. I think she understands the seriousness. I think the filter with which she tries to find the answers is skewed. Like, I think the joke is the fact
that
she found it really serious, but she's still filtering through her life experience. So to her, she's like, maybe what they were missing was that female community that was so bolstering for me and was such
a
positive outlet. And like, but what I love is everyone's like, okay. Like, she's trying, but her filter is flawed.
She's trying to use her at the moment, which is, I don't want to say limiting. I know many people had very positive experiences in sororities, but like, she's only filtering it through sort of her lens at the moment, I guess is what I'm getting at. And that she will eventually sort of be able to see her stories outside that lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I think is great is like, this is one of those excellent moments of character development where we didn't just quote unquote fix Corky and make her a Murphy. We like, she is growing so much. And so now she's in a position of wanting to have a serious topic and dive into it and really try to understand from a human perspective.
Yeah.
And it's just, the joke is that, you know, it's Corky looking for a humanitarian perspective.
Yeah.
it's sweet. She's trying real hard.
It is very sweet.
Hey, that is a fact, I guess. It is a fact that exists. And that's the thing with journalism and research, is there are facts in front of you and you can make something of them or not. And she did. I'm proud of her. She's very proud of herself. She also has a beautiful magenta blazer with like a black floral shirt underneath. It's a beautiful outfit.
It is, yeah.
Murphyson, for your color resolution on your screen, was it like a peach color for you?
It feels more paler than peach for me.
Right?
And that's the thing that really got me, is that usually someone with her coloring wouldn't look so damn amazing in such a pale color.
She looks incredible. it's actually kind of amazing that Candace looks good in both versions of 80s female fashion. We've talked about the, you know, the early 80s and the soft pastels and the sweetness that we kind of correlate with Corky. And she also looks incredible in the harsher, stronger tones of later 80s, early 90s. I also want to point out that Jim bringing this up, this is something that will be alluded to later in the episode, which is Jim's ability to wrap up the evening improvising, ad-libbing in the moment about the show that had just happened. So he was listening to her report and then comments on a fact from the report that not only is a something of interest that he noted, but also celebrates his fellow coworker.
Yeah.
Like, he's actually elevating her and making her look good and bolstering her self-esteem. So I just wanted to point that out, what Jim does here in his wrap-up. So he signs off, "This has been another edition of FYI," and I went, "The Murphy Brown Podcast," and says goodnight. John signals that they are out. That's a wrap, everyone. Hell Week is officially over. Miles is leaning on the monitor next to John. He looks pained and exhausted. The entire studio erupts in cheers. Frank starts saying, "What a week. Killer deadlines. Guests bailing. Everything that could go wrong did." He puts his elbow down on his chair and the entire thing collapses beneath him.
I love this joke. I know that it's like it's a pratfall so is such funny. An old joke, but it works for him, particularly because then... he's below the desk and you're, "Oh man," like just the voice of like Frank, because you know everything always like that happens to Frank. He's just like,
well, and it's not just like, I think in some he would have put his elbow down and the arm would have fallen off, or he would have like leaned back and the chair would have tipped over. The way the chair crumples like it's made out of cardboard beneath him, so he just completely disappears flat out of screen. That's, and then we just get that,
that's the comedy of it, him just falling out of frame. Oh,
it's incredible. Great. It's incredible. I've seen people fall out of frame multiple ways on a chair, but the way that the entire chair seems to break, not just a part of it, not just weight, the entire chair seems to just collapse beneath him. I actually want to know the tech behind it, but that doesn't matter right now.
Yeah, and I think for a show that is not known for physical humor, when they do have moments of it, I appreciate it.
Murphy stands up and challenges Frank, asks what he's complaining about. Her earpiece blew out halfway through her interview. She takes her earpiece out, and then asks, "Where are we getting our equipment these days? The Home Shopping Network?" And I want to call out
this
unique direction choice that I see in the, specifically in this opening scene, which I think is freaking brilliant for a very specific reason. And like, shockingly, we love Barnett's direction. Shocking to hear, I know. But what I love about this, and I'm curious if this is part of just like when you work on a show long enough, you get to play with different things every once in a while, because we've been noticing some fun camera and blocking and direction choices this season so far. But so she takes out her earpiece. She says this line about the Home Shopping Network. We see her begin to, and then we cut to the next frame and she's tossing it in the air toward Miles. The camera tracks the earpiece in the air. Miles catches it. He then tosses it to John and then continues speaking and walks back into to the desk. What I love about it, and it's something that we'll see later with a fax that comes in, is this movement and the camera tracking the movement. It makes the scene seem very alive, like live television, and exciting. It's putting this kind of clock on the action of like, they're all in a hurry and they're trying to get out of here. And then this thing needs to happen and we're following it. And it's so alive and not static that it really adds to what happens in this opening scene. And I just think it's really, really fun to watch.
It also shows what a well-oiled machine they are, that they all like work really well together from in front of the camera and behind the scenes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The entire scene is like ready to go. They can do this in one shot. It's incredible. Which I think is actually very interesting that they do... They clearly shot her mid close up of her taking it out and saying that line to Frank. And then they cut to the wide shot that they did for that piece of action. But they clearly did the whole thing in one take at that moment. So I think it's fun that we get the cut to the actual wide. Anyway, so Miles, after tossing over to John, steps up to the desk and gives a speech to the room. No one stops. Everyone's just packing up and trying to get out of there. He says, "Guys, you got through with flying colors. It's weeks like this that push us to the wall, test everything you got. And when you come through it the way you did..." At this point, Frank has appeared next to him, just brushing off his person as Miles talks. "Well, what can I say? Stunning effort, everybody. Jimbo, Corkster, Frankarini." And Miles rubs Frank's head like he's like a dog. Like he's like ruffles his hair with his little reiny. And then he pulls his hand back, looks at it horrified. Frank slowly looks at him, says, "I've asked you not to do that, Miles." And Miles is just staring at his hand in horror. And then Frank just goes, "How many did you get?" Freaking Grant shot tries to wipe them back onto Frank's head. Just, it's so, the idea, the joke, this goes back to that, what Diane's saying, that Joe was going to stop telling his insecurities and neuroses to them because they would write them into episodes. Yeah,
this feels like that.
Oh, my God. The how many did you get?
I have something to share with you that I accidentally came across that I thought would be appropriate for this. So apparently Frank is mentioned in a book from the 90s called The Joy of Baldness, Men with Less Hair and the Women Who Love Them.
No.
Yes.
No.
Came across in a Google search.
Bless their hearts.
Just to mention that. Not a chapter, though.
My God, that little sequence, the two of them, it was suddenly just like Oscar-winning drama.
Also, is this the first time that Miles has a nickname for everybody? Because I'm pretty sure.
I believe so. It is interesting that he doesn't say anything to Murph. Just as the other three of the gang. Obviously, we know he has nicknames for Murphy.
Yeah.
But it was funny that it was Jimbo, Corkster, Frank, or Rini. I mean, rules of three and all that good stuff. But I was like, wait, why didn't Murphy get her nickname? But yeah, I do think it's the first time he's listed everyone barring Murphy.
That's so Miles to me, his nicknaming of people. And so it felt like, oh, yeah, this is the Miles that I remember. But we do so many of these episodes, they all sort of blend together. So we may have done this before. And also, this is the episode that I took our sticker, which our Patreon members can get, which has everyone's nicknames from Murphy to Frank. But I got most of them from this episode.
So at this moment, we hear phone Miles. And Murphy says, probably his girlfriend, which this is.
Is Audrey.
So probably his girlfriend. She calls him after every show to tell him. And then she does this little hip twist dance. What a little stud man he is. And then she yells, hurry up, Miles. We want to go to Phil's. And Jim chimes in with, and put this miserable week behind us. I've never looked forward to the old watering hole more. I warn you, I may cross against the light tonight. I don't care. Corky, and I want to preface this with, Corky thinks she's talking to just the gang.
Yes, I get
that. In this moment.
Yeah.
She really thinks she's just talking to her buddies, forgetting that everyone's been talking to the room the whole time. And she says, gee, all of them had such a terrible week and her story went so well. She feels so guilty. Which, kudos for this moment of self-awareness from Corky. I think that's really, really sweet. Oh, like, she wasn't being overly... She is a sweetheart, but it wasn't one of those things where she's being like... Sometimes Corky thinks she's done a really great job or talks herself up in a way that is perhaps unearned. And this is a genuine, like, coworker moment. She's not being... so unaware or so full of herself that she's saying something that's actually hurtful. She genuinely was like, I feel bad. My story went really well. And I feel bad. I recognize this happened. And she says, you know what? Tonight, Phil's is on her. And everyone in the studio cheers. Corky realizes what she said. Oh, you're all coming?
Now we are.
Everyone starts to leave. And Miles rises from the phone saying, hold it. It's not a wrap yet. Connie Chung got hung up in traffic, and there's no one to do the national news break. They're throwing it over to FYI. Everyone starts to grumble, and Miles with a true, hey, 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 in his little, like, yipper dog yell that he'll do sometimes to people. I love Miles in this section. He's a very good producer.
Oh, yes, in this he moment. Is.
He's incredible. This is one of those scenes where I love it when you see Miles kind of turn into everyone's parent against his own will.
Yeah, he's such a good papa bear.
And then he turns and says, Jim, they've asked for you. You okay with that? Jim says, no problem, Miles. I consider it an honor. He's such a good man. And I love because right before it cuts away, you see Murphy begin to smile at him as she like takes his coat.
Yeah, she loves that about him.
Oh, she loves it so much. And what I love in that moment, because it's so quick, it's like as it's cutting away, you see her start to smile. And I could not tell you if it's Murphy or Candace in that moment.
Right.
Looking at him. And it doesn't matter because both are correct.
Yeah. I also want to point out something that I never heard as a kid. And again, it may just be we have so much better copies. And, you know, when you VCR something, it can get a little choppy. Did you notice that John says, what's Maury doing?
Yeah, I did hear that.
For those of you who have not listened to our episode when we talked about Connie Chung, she is married to Maury Povich.
Uh-huh.
Oh, we have to stay. Can't they get her husband to do it? Oh, no, John. That's not how this works. But it was still pretty funny.
So this is what this is my next quick moment of blocking and camera work.
Which is great.
Which is Miles. It's incredible. So everyone kind of starts to flurry around. Miles says, heads up, people, less than a minute to air. Hit the lights. Leave me one camera. What's the copy? And at that moment, John comes in from behind our camera. John says, flying off the facts. Miles says, thank you, John. They use this movement of John coming in with a copy to hand it to Miles. And then Miles hands it over and Jim is on his way to the desk. You have this idea that they really only have 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, this section is longer than 20 seconds of what happens here with these lines. But they make you feel like it's about to happen. And then what I love is, again, as producer, Miles knows who he needs to focus on. So he's like, Jim, do you need anything? Jim says, a pencil. Great, a pencil. Who's got a pencil? No one says anything. One pencil. Nobody has a pencil? And Murphy's looking under clipboards on top of the
monitor. Yeah, everyone's helping, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Here's my question. Where did Jim's pencil from the air go?
I mean, they were ready to go. Maybe there's someone who comes in and cleans everything up can leave.
That's what I'm wondering, because having tracked the scene, but like someone came in and stole Jim's pencil, and I think this is all their fault.
Oh, so it's not Murphy's fault. It's the pencil.
Pencil threw everything off. I'm a creature of habit. If he had the pencil, he could have focused on the pencil, but no. So Miles then becomes me in this section and starts screaming, the man needs a pencil. Where are all the pencils? Jim says, he's all right. He'll do it. Again, Miles being me says, he'll do without.
But the way he says it, he'll do
without. Dial, everybody.
He'll do without.
He like gestures him and runs over and goes, an unbelievable pro, Jim Dial, everybody.
I love that line to delivery so much.
He's like, everyone, don't worry. He'll do it without.
But it's Miles pushing, not Grant pushing. It's like,
In this moment of they're touching up Jim's makeup, everyone's settling. He's finally looking at the copy that he's going to have to say. Corky just casually asks for hands of everyone going to Phil's. Spoiler, it's everybody. And there's also one guy behind her who puts up two hands. I took some screenshots of this. I'm going to meme this.
I didn't notice that.
I will send to you. I have screenshots. Murphy says this is such a pain. She's starving to death. It better be something really interesting in those pages. And we see the evil smile begin. And she gets the entire room to pay attention to her. While vacationing in Kennebunkport, Maine, President Bush sat on a wasp and was rushed to a nearby hospital. Frank is, you're kidding. And he rushes over as the group begins to laugh. She says, the stinger was removed. The president was released. And tonight is resting comfortably. Yeah, on his stomach. And then she does a Bush impression that I will not do. Dana Carvey does much better, which is, Barbara, I'd like to turn over, but it wouldn't be prudent. Not at this juncture.
So I have something that I found out by accident recently, not at all in research for this. It just happened. I've been listening to Dana Carvey's podcast, Fly on the Wall with David Spade.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought up the fact that it wouldn't be prudent, not at this juncture, is something that they wrote. That Bush never, ever said it.
Yeah.
And of course he didn't. Like, as an adult, I understand that. But as a kid, because I'm remembering this as a kid, it's interesting watching this going, okay, so that wordage is so in the vernacular now because of SNL. Mm-hmm. Another sitcom is taking a line written by another show to put it in here. Maybe not realizing it or not, but knowing that that will be something that people will recognize. But also, I think it might just be that, like, that is so inherently, it's like a Mobius strip, right? We don't know where it begins or it ends because SNL, particularly at that time, doing political figures shaped who they were in the pop culture and how they were seen.
Yes. And so when I was doing this section, the second she said that, I immediately was like, not gonna do it. And I went and looked up because I think similarly for a lot of people with Sarah Palin saying, I can see Russia from my house. People don't know if she said that or if that was a Tina Fey quote.
Yeah.
And similarly, I was like, I don't remember if he actually said, wouldn't be prudent, not at this juncture. So I Googled to try and find.
Oh, you did.
Is it just SNL or was it a real quote? Because I was like, I don't actually know which one it was. And I was like, if we're going to reference this, I want to make sure that I'm not just only referencing Dana Carvey. But no, he did not say it. I also love there's a great Atlantic interview with Dana Carvey where one of the things he says is the way to do the president, Bush Senior in this scenario, George H.W., the way to do the president is to start out with Mr. Rogers. Then you add a little John Wayne. You put them together, you got George Herbert Walker Bush.
Oh, that's great.
I was a massive Dana Carvey fan as a kid. Oh, still am, obviously, because he's great. But specifically, the not gonna do it, not gonna do it. Killed me. I genuinely thought that he actually said that and they had used that in coffee.
So did I. So did I until this podcast and I was flabbergasted.
Yeah, so good. So as she's doing this and everyone's cracking up and Jim is very seriously just looking at his copy. He has his makeup Kleenex in his collar, unfazed by her antics. And she says, probably my favorite joke of the group, which is, figures it's a wasp. It would have been political suicide to sit on a minority.
It's a really great joke.
And when we say wasp, I'm assuming the majority of our listeners know we mean white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Miles chastises Murphy. She says, I wonder if the wasp acted alone. Where is the Warren Commission when you need them? For those who don't know, the Warren Commission was the president's commission on the assassination of President Kennedy, mm-hmm. named the Warren Commission for Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was the chairman. Murphy's still going and does a great Groucho. Lauren, would you like to do the Groucho?
I heard of a bee in my bonnet, but this is ridiculous.
Full with the giant fake cigar. Miles, full stress, hunched over the part of the desk where Corky normally sits that they can't see in the camera at this moment, shushes them. And Jim begins. Murphy is in his eyeline, impersonating the wasp with little horns on her head and using a pink tail comb as the stinger in her mouth. Pro-choice and right-to-life advocates, we now cut to Murphy still in his eyeline, now aiming the comb for Miles's bent-over rear. Clash in Florida. She stings Miles. He spins to her very innocent face as she hides the tail comb. And now we begin the quote. While vacationing in Kennebunkport, Maine today, Jim begins to smile. President Bush sat in a wasp and was rushed to the hospital. He has begun laughing. The stinger was removed. Everyone is now horrified. The entire room has gone sober. I'm not even going to read the rest of it because you can't, because he's barely reading it. Jim begins laughing so hard. He is waving his hand in front of his face to try and stop himself. He says, no, I'm sorry. This isn't funny. And begins bursting out laughing in the full Charlie Kimbrough laughter. You know what it is. That studio has sobered up. So
oh my God. And Murphy looks like a child with their hand caught in the cookie jar. She feels awful. Everyone looks at her. It just, the look on her face through the next scene, like she just feels so horrible. But because it's Murphy, she can't admit that she made a mistake.
And what is so, like, this is, we always talk about how much we love when Jim laughs because it's this full body. It just bursts out of him and he cannot help it. Mm-hmm. And this is full-throated, like, blah-ha-ha-ing laughter. And he's waving his arms in front of him as if there's something in front of him, that a wasp perhaps, that he's just trying to get away out of him. He says, stay tuned to your local station for, waving more of his arms in front of him, for complete coverage. It fades out as he falls over the desk, laughing into his arms, and the studio quietly looks horrified.
Mm-hmm. Cut to the bullpen. Corky is on the phone with Will, something we have seen before, and she's trying to encourage him as a writer. But when she gets off the phone, she tells Frank how frustrated she is that he's still working on a title. First, it was Jenny and Eli, A Tale of the West. Then it was Penelope and Demetrius, A Greek Odyssey. And then Bill and Dave, A Love Story. Now, I know that Bill and Dave, A Love Story is the laugh line, but go, Will.
Yeah, truly. I honestly, that's a quite the character turn.
It is quite the character turn. I mean, is there a possible, you know, small kernel of information that Will is perhaps bi?
I've decided that Will may be happier if he was more honest with himself.
I would like to accept that headcanon. Either way, progressive, cool guy. I mean, well, progressive. I mean, he's the one who's staying home and the wife is making the money. So already we know he's progressive for 1990. So Murphy gets off the elevator with a woman in a full leopard jumpsuit and coat with a pink belt, like a hot pink Barbie belt, a cigarette, her hair in curlers and a hairnet. And Murphy is so worried as she's following her, like as if her face is like, please don't sit at my desk. Please don't sit at my desk. And of course she does. And she's like, oh, I knew it. Of course it was you. The joke is that the woman looks at Murphy and goes, oh, this is your desk? Screw it. I'm taking early retirement.
I'm obsessed with her.
Obsessed with her. And I would like to help everyone be more obsessed with her. Because as quick as this scene is, this is Barbara Perry, a television veteran. She is actually our second actor from The Dick Van Dyke Show this year. Because in the first season of The Dick Van Dyke Show, she played Maury Amsterdam's wife.
Pickles.
So she was on The Dick Van Dyke Show playing writer Buddy Sorrell, a.k.a. Maury Amsterdam's wife, Pickles, just in the first season.
I love Pickles.
Pickles is adorable. I mean, you can already tell from her voice, she has a very sort of old radio voice, they would say. You know, like it's got this sort of like character to it, gravelly, it's interesting. So Perry was born in 1921. She lived to be 97. Her father was a keyboardist and a conductor, and her mother sang in the chorus at the Met, the Metropolitan Opera in New York, which led to her at the age of four making her debut as Trouble in Madame Butterfly. She was a member of the children's ballet of the Met's Corps de Ballet. She went on to study dance with a specialty in tap. She eventually came to L.A., where she performed at the Hollywood Bowl in the 1930s for choreographers like Agnes DeMille. Her parents started a dance studio called Perry Studios. She made her film debut in a film with John Barrymore. She also did The Mystery of Edwin Drood in 35 with Claude Rains. Then she went on to have a similar career as Rosemarie, where she headlined in nightclubs from Cuba, Chicago, London, the Coconut Grove in Los Angeles. She opened for legends like Lena Horne and Peggy Lee. She appeared on Broadway and off-Broadway in the late 50s, including a show with Eddie Foy Jr. as his dance partner. And I bring that up because I think a lot of people know the film with Bob Hope from 55, The Seven Little Foys. Obviously, that's about his family. She studied acting at the Academy of Dramatic Art in London and then came home to appear in The Donna Reed Show, Bewitched, My Three Sons, Barnaby Jones, Andy Griffith, St. Elsewhere, and Newhart. She's also been in Father of the Bride, The Backup Plan. Her most recent credits before she passed away were How I Met Your Mother and Baskets on FX with Louis Anderson. She also was in a one-woman show that got a lot of awards off-Broadway called Passionate Ladies. And shortly before she died, she received the Founders Award from SAG-AFTRA.
Don't worry, she was also in Murder, She Wrote, one episode. I just want to interject real fast while you're talking about Barbara Perry. Everyone, please go to IMDb and go to Barbara Perry's page, because her profile picture, like the main picture, is this. I like want to frame this in the same way that I want to frame. Great. There's a very famous photo of a young Maggie Smith where she's like holding a drink and looks just incredible. Same thing with this picture of Barbara Perry. I want to frame it. It's this black and white. She's holding like a teacup and saucer. She's got this like beautiful like feathered headdress and this glorious like star choker necklace. She looks so adorable, so fabulous. And juxtaposing that to this secretary that comes in, it's so good.
So Murphy sees Corky and Frank, but Frank is very unhappy with Murphy for what she has done. Murphy, of course, the words are saying that she did nothing wrong, but we can see on her face that she knows that she is very, very guilty and feels very, very bad. She feels that no one probably saw it. You know, that they probably went to the bathroom, or they went and they, you know, went to walk the dog. And I'm thinking she's kind of not wrong. Like a lot of times, because we couldn't just pause it like we can now. You would use that time to do things that you couldn't do before.
Yeah.
But there were people who did watch it, because Miles arrives and he has the public reaction and he reads off these little slips of paper. Childish, disgraceful. Wasp stings hurt. And that was from the president. Murphy, again, will not admit that it was a mistake. Corky thinks that Jim must feel humiliated. Murphy thinks that they're all overreacting and says that if Jim is upset, that they should all apologize for what they did. And everyone's like, no, 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 no. You, Murphy,
no, no.
You did this. Then Jim arrives in a trench coat that's like buttoned up all the way to the top. A little newsboy hat.
My secret agent man.
And dark sunglasses. He does not look happy. He took the stairs up 17 flights, which everyone is agog about. Murphy tries to be nice to Jim, and Jim is trying to be polite, but he is very not happy with Murphy. He is very...
Can I just say my favorite quote?
Please.
Of his in this
moment? What does he say?
Was specifically the, it's a nice day in the stairwell. I needed the exercise. The it's a nice day in the stairwell killed me. Please continue. I just, ugh.
Everyone encourages Jim to sit down for the meeting. They go to sit down, but Jim is not sitting. He won't be going to the meeting, and he is requesting to be relieved from next week's show. He needs time off. And Murphy tries to persuade him, and he's not taking it. He is giving no emotion. Mm-hmm. He is obviously holding back how deeply embarrassed and angry he is with Murphy. He is resolute. He is not going to be convinced by Miles. And I don't think I have ever seen Jim this upset with his friends.
This scene in particular, I kept waiting for the joke. And I think what's so effective about it is that there isn't one. Like, it starts with the, like, it's a nice day in the stairwell, and we're kind of laughing about what he looks like. But this particular conversation, like, he's serious, he's serious, and we're kind of waiting for release.
Yeah, and there isn't.
And
we feel terrible for him. And then we also, like, through Candace's face sort of map that she's going through, face journey, is just, you get what's happening in the scene without the dialogue. That you feel bad because Murphy feels awful, as she should. Because sometimes she doesn't feel awful about things that she does, right? Like,
yeah,
it was Frank. She maybe it would take her maybe a couple of scenes to feel awful, but she wouldn't, like, right off the bat. She knows what she's done is wrong.
And she wouldn't, even if she did, she wouldn't show this kind of vulnerability, like this, like, air of almost pleading for him to release this tension between them. And he won't do it.
And it's like an adult.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, normally in this show, in a moment like this, there's going to be a punchline that's going to come up that releases them from this tension, and it's not happening. And it's, I think, really uncomfortable to watch in a very intentional way. It's a beautiful moment of our dramedy that we talk about. Like, you feel awful for him. And honestly for her, because she's not being released from what she
like
did.
It just shows how dire it is. Like, this is a really big deal. So something that's really interesting about this episode is how it is framed during a really bad week that they had, right? Like, where it sounds like there was a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And people say, you know, laughter is the best medicine, but, like, technically, laughter is kind of, like, really good medicine, you know? And I think that this is a great topic to sort of briefly discuss because of the topic of the episode, but because this is a TV show that we enjoy, that makes us happy, that makes us laugh. The point of a sitcom is to laugh. Mm-hmm. And technically, laughter reduces the level of stress hormones like cortisol, epinephrine, aka adrenaline, dopamine, and actually growth hormones, which that surprised me.
Yeah.
The short-term effects of laughter include stimulating organs. Laughter enhances your intake of oxygen-rich air, stimulates your heart, lungs, and muscles, and increases the endorphins that are released in your brain. I think the endorphins is a big thing.
And happy people just don't kill their husbands.
Sure, absolutely. It can also relax your muscles for up to 45 minutes.
You know, y'all, we need to laugh more.
We really do. It improves your breathing. It reduces stress hormones. Was also some articles that said that it may help with respiratory illnesses.
Okay, sure. I mean, especially with the idea of getting oxygen and, like, you know, something we talk about a lot as vocalists is, like, you can't laugh without having a full-bodied breath connection. Like, you actually breathe correctly when you're laughing really hard because you have to use your diaphragm to expel the air in a laugh. So it makes sense that that would actually help your respiratory function.
Yeah. And then connecting to that, long-term effects is that it does improve your immune system, which would make sense if you are fighting some sort of illness, right? Studies suggest that laughter can boost the immune system by increasing the production of immune cells and antibodies. A stronger immune system can obviously help handle stress and prevent illness. Really, the main sort of thesis of all of this is that it is an amazing stress reliever, whether it just lightens your mood or that it physically helps your physical health as well as your mental health. And I think that's really amazing. They said it can also improve your self-esteem.
I believe that. I'm just thinking about all the times I've had, like, a good laugh and, like, what that actually feels like afterwards, like the the kind of echo after a good laugh with someone or by yourself. I'm like, yeah, that's all tracks, honestly.
It really was amazing. And then also interesting enough is that there is something called laughter therapy, which technically has been around since the 14th century when a French surgeon, Henri de Montauville, believed that patients benefited from relatives and friends visiting them to tell jokes. In the 16th century, there were people like actually Martin Luther who used humor when working with depressed people. Through the 17th century, the 18th century, and in the United States, it became popular more in the 20th century during the polio epidemic in the 1930s, where hospitals hired clowns to cheer up sick children. And actually, for those who know the movie Patch Adams, which is based on a real person, Dr. Hunter Patch Adams. He established, and I didn't know the name of it because I haven't seen Patch Adams. I'm sorry, everybody.
What?
But it's called the Gesundheit Institute.
Yeah.
Because Gesundheit means health in German. But, it, you know, it also makes me think of sneezing. In 1972, dedicated to spreading humor and joy to patients. Lastly, I want to mention that in the 1960s that there was an ology, so to speak, that was started at Stanford University by Dr. William F. Fry, known as, and I hope I say this right because I'm not great with my Greek, gelotology. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. Coming from the Greek word gelos, meaning laughter.
Cool.
I think that the thesis of this episode is that watching Murphy Brown is good for your health.
Yeah, everyone. We're just taking our prescriptions.
Yeah. And Jim leaves. Next scene.
Join us next week for part two.
Thank you for listening, friends.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please show us your support by
liking,
subscribing,
and interacting with us on social media.
Our handle everywhere is
at Murphy Brown Pod.
You can also email us at
murphybrownpod@gmail.com
or visit our website at
murphybrownpod.com.
Share us with your friends.
Give us a 5-star rating
wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by checking out our Patreon.
You can donate once.
Or be a recurring subscriber.
And access exclusive deep dives on Murphy Brown and other related topics.
As well as bonus content we had to cut for time.
100% of what you donate goes toward creating this podcast.
So any way you are able to support, we deeply appreciate.
And we'll see you next time.
For another edition of FYI.
The Murphy Brown Podcast. I'm ready.
Okay. You sure?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be as ready as I ever am.
Ready.
I'm just dying
here. I've got the black lung. Shit.
Hold, please.
Oh, my God.
I have too many drinks. All right.